This is the best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
We almost never do it. We're opening the show with baseball. Down the stretch we come. There's only four or five games left in the season for everybody. And less, potentially, if my math is a little bit off here. The L.A. Dodgers have now fallen into second place in the NL West behind the Colorado Rockies, and the Chicago Cubs and the Milwaukee Brewers are battling it out down the stretch in the NL Central. Both of those races going to come down to the absolute latest. Now, the challenge here is that at least Milwaukee and Chicago, either or, are going to be in as members of the wild card. But, man, this is a messy situation. I bring in resident L.A. Dodger expert Danny G and let you take this away. How big of a choke job is this by the Dodgers, and what's going to happen?
I don't know if you want to call it a choke job, because the Dodgers have been playing like this all season. Super highs, super lows all throughout the season. What was it, just a week or so ago that a lot of the Dodger players were saying it was the loudest Chavez Ravine had sounded all year long when Chris Taylor hit that walk-off home run. And that gave the Dodger fans some hope that they were going to start playing the way they played all last season when they were like comeback kids. Now their pitching has started to really stink it up again, and we saw that the past couple of nights against the Diamondbacks. So suddenly the Colorado Rockies, with that home field advantage that they have, and playing against the gutless Phillies, and the Dodgers are looking up at the scoreboard. It's 7-0 in the fifth inning in Colorado, and they're like, uh-oh, rut-row. And what did the Dodgers pitching do? Choked it up again. So, Dodger fans are really nervous right now going into San Francisco, Clay. And you know one thing about the Giants? Huge, one of the hugest rivalries in all of sports, Dodgers-Giants. The Giants always seem to have the Dodgers' number in clutch regular season games. So now the Dodgers pretty much need to sweep the Giants in San Francisco.
And also, the San Francisco has really nothing to play for except to ruin the Dodger season, which is actually kind of everything to play for, right?
Yeah, it's going to be like their World Series. You're going to see them hustling around the bases. The fans there are going to be doing their usual beat LA chant. It's going to be rowdy there for the first time in San Francisco pretty much since the last series when the Dodgers were there last time.
So the Rockies have four games left. The Dodgers have three games left.
Correct.
What's the panic
level
at right now?
I would say a 7. Roberto just said 8. Yeah, because Dodger fans have seen this movie before where they need a win and the Giants snatch it away from them, because the San Francisco Giants, they live to, you know, I was going to say a word there I shouldn't say. They live to all over a Dodgers parade. I mean, they love it. So that's
I don't
that's
think
what's
you can
good.
Say that. I don't think you can say that word either.
Really? Dump that, Roberto.
I'm pretty sure that's not allowed to be said.
Well, you are the ship's captain during the safe harbor right now.
Yeah. All right. So what else should people like me, who really don't pay attention to the Major League Baseball season until it's postseason, all right? I mean, I do the same thing kind of in basketball, any of these NHL, any of these seasons that last forever. I don't get that worked up or pay that much attention to the regular season, because we still have like 3 months of postseason to pay attention to, an entire month of postseason in baseball. So what would you set the odds at right now? And I think we've got Morosi in hour two, right?
Yeah.
So what would you say? He's our baseball expert, which is the reason I'm asking. What would you set your odds at? What do you think the likelihood is that the Dodgers end up winning this division?
We're going to see how much guts the Dodgers have, what kind of fortitude they have, what kind of what they're made out of this season. I mean, like I said, they're kind of a question mark all year long. It's been a wild roller coaster kind of season for the Dodgers. So I'm the positive one in the Dodger chat room. My older brother, cousin, the every single Dodgers game, if I want to know what's going on, I just jump into that family chat room where all the Dodger fans are. And yesterday, both of them were so negative. Well, we better hope for the Rockies to go on a little losing streak right here. You know, we might not have playoffs at all, and then they're laying down all the different mathematical, you know, things that could happen for the Dodgers. Like, for instance, they could wind up playing a one-game playoff against the Cubs for a wild card spot. Or if they wind up tied with the Rockies when everything's said and done after the weekend, there could be a 163rd game where the Dodgers and Rockies play a one-game playoff to see who wins the division. So there's lots of different opportunities and possibilities here, but the Dodgers just need to go into San Francisco and sweep the Giants.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, see what I mean with the negative
it's
Dodger
not
fans?
The Rockies are playing against the Phillies today, who are the probably the worst franchise in all of baseball with the most losses in the history of baseball. And then they have the Nationals who are yet to determine who's going to pitch for them this weekend. So the Rockies are going to – I think the Rockies are going to run the table.
Well, this always gets to be challenging when you get to these late season situations and everybody isn't in the same kind of situation, obviously. Like, some of these teams are just playing out the thread. And they put, you know, they're resting their starters and they've got younger guys in and they decide, you know what, we don't have any, you know, there's no point in trying out our typical pitching rotation. Let's bring up some of the young guys and let them get a chance to pitch in Major League Baseball, see how they do. So this is, I mean, a panic time, I think, for the city of Los Angeles. Now, at least you got LeBron and you got the Rams on fire and the Chargers, who I think are about to get on a really good run, starting with the 49ers this weekend. But, man. This would be a real kick in the teeth to not win the NL West after what, the sweeping the Rockies. What was that, like a week ago?
A week ago,
when
yeah.
When everything seemed like it was perfect?
Yeah, that was a week ago.
To open up a 2.5 game lead, and now they've lost that 2.5 game lead and are down a half game. What do you think is going to happen in the other series between the Cubs and the Brewers? Does that matter?
Yeah, to be honest with you, we haven't been paying attention because so much is riding on just what our team needs to do to take care of their own business that I haven't been paying attention to Yelich or any of them.
We'll ask John Morosi. We'll cover this in more detail with a guy who's pretty much an expert in Major League Baseball when we talk to him in hour two. So all of that's still to come. All right, the other big news I would say that's out there is we have our first major impact from the new 4-game transfer rule. And some of you might say, well, there's been some other guys who've, like, this is the first really major impact. Kelly Bryant, who is a 16-2 as a starter at Clemson, has made the decision to leave Clemson and preserve his final year of eligibility. He's going to go somewhere else in college football. And this came because he was replaced by a new young gun quarterback, Trevor Lawrence, who everybody is agog over at Clemson. And we have, I believe, audio of Dabo Swinney talking about this. We'll play that for you. This now means that Clemson is in the hands of a young quarterback. It's very similar to the dilemma that Alabama faced that we talked about a lot in the offseason. Who's going to get the start, Tua Tagovailoa or Jalen Hurts? And the expectation was, well, whoever doesn't get this job will end up transferring. It doesn't look like that's going to happen at Alabama at all. Instead, it's Clemson that's going to have the issue with one guy leaving and the other guy staying. Let's listen to what Dabo had to say about that.
Saddened and disappointed that he's chosen to leave the team, but I really have absolutely nothing bad that I can say about Kelly Bryant. He's one of the best young people I've ever been around, and even though I don't think this is a great decision, I certainly respect it, and it doesn't change anything that I feel for Kelly. As a coach, sometimes you have to make the tough decisions that are in the best interest of the team, and this is one of those decisions. And I would make it all over again because I believe that it's what's right for our team. And I feel like Kelly would have continued to help us win and play a lot, but it's not what he wanted to do. I definitely feel like he's been given a fair shot. I don't think there's any question about that. But at the end of the day, you know, this is not middle school. You know, you, there's tough decisions that have to be made at this level, and you got to do what's best for the team.
That's all Dabo, and I'm going to defend Dabo before I get into this anymore. If he wanted to, and I think Dabo said this himself, he could have waited until after game four to make the decision about replacing Kelly Bryant with a new quarterback, and nobody would have blinked at all because that's the way competitions work, and he would have sabotaged and locked in Kelly Bryant and not given him an opportunity to transfer and go elsewhere. So I actually think from that perspective, Dabo couldn't have been much more honest than he actually was in his decision-making. Now, I think in a larger sense, one of the questions that many people are going to have is this good for college football, for us setting the precedent of, you know what, if you are not going to be the starter, you just go ahead and walk out. I don't blame in any respect Kelly Bryant for taking advantage of this opportunity. It makes, to me, complete sense that if you are a senior and you know that you're going to be a backup for the rest of the year, and let's say you've already won a national championship as a backup, as Kelly Bryant already has, it doesn't necessarily surprise me that you would make the decision to leave. Now, the question I think Kelly Bryant's going to have is he really that good? Because one of the biggest, I think, flaws in college football thinking in recent years has been this idea that a graduate transfer who's coming in for 1 year is going to be an amazing addition to your team and be a difference maker. Almost all of the time, when a graduate transfer comes in, and again, some people are going to be tweeting me and they're going to be like, what about Cam Newton? What about Troy Aikman back in the day? No. I'm saying graduate transfer. When you come in with only 1 year of eligibility remaining, when you do that, it's almost always the case that you aren't that good with your new team. Now, there are exceptions. Russell Wilson transferred to Wisconsin and was phenomenal. Took Wisconsin to the Rose Bowl in his 1 year with Wisconsin, right? But that's a little bit of a unique situation because the guy who he was replaced by, Mike Glennon, was also an NFL draft pick. And I believe Mike Glennon was drafted higher than Russell Wilson in an NFL draft. And he ended up making a lot of money, Mike Glennon did, as a quarterback in the NFL too. I think he's the backup still for Mitch Trubisky, if I'm not mistaken, with the Chicago Bears. Wherever he is, he's in the NFL too, and he's had a pretty decent NFL career in terms of longevity and money that he has made. So Russell Wilson's decision to leave there was a rare one because there were two future NFL draft picks that were battling it out for the final job there. Other than Russell Wilson, I can give you a long list of players that have transferred in. You're probably thinking of them right now that expected that they would compete and or win the job, and then the result was, you know what, we ended up not being very good. It's happened as recently as last year for the Florida Gators. Remember Malik Zaire when he was transferring in and everybody said, oh man, this guy's going to be amazing. He's going to be great. He's going to fix everything that's wrong with the Florida offense. And then he was mediocre to bad. Look at what happened with, back in the day, Jeremiah Masoli, who's one of the first people that I remember doing this with Ole Miss. Transferred in, not very good. Look at what happened with this year with Tennessee. Stanford's quarterback, backup, transfers in, Crist, and he can't even beat out Jarrett Guarantano. By and large, if you are a graduate transfer quarterback, and you were not good enough to win the job at your existing place, you're probably not going to be very good at a new place. Now, again, Russell Wilson is the guy you can point to and say, no, that's not true. He's the aberration. He's the rarity. Larger scale here. What does this mean for Clemson? I think it's actually pretty substantial for Clemson because it means that if something happens to Trevor Lawrence, and it very often is the case that something happens to a starting quarterback, Clemson's potentially in trouble here now. And it's also fascinating to consider the way the media covered this controversy at Alabama and almost the fact that Clemson got no attention at all around this. And it ends up being Clemson, not Alabama, that's losing a player in the middle of the season and now is in, I think, a little bit more difficult proposition than Alabama faces. Nick Saban has protected himself here. Because if Tua Tagovailoa suddenly gets hurt, and I don't think there's a single person out there right now who's watched Alabama play at all that wouldn't say, oh, Tua is infinitely better than Jalen Hurts right now. Doesn't mean Jalen Hurts is bad. Jalen Hurts is 26-2, I believe it is, as a starter. He comes in and he's a functional backup. But Tua is electric, whereas Jalen Hurts, just okay. So when you break this down, somehow Nick Saban, assuming that Jalen Hurts is going to play in one of these games going forward, has managed to keep Jalen Hurts there as a backup in the event that something happens to Tua to protect his championship drive, whereas Dabo Swinney has actually ended up losing his guy. Consider how much attention these stories got in the offseason. I bet the Alabama story was covered 100 or 1,000 to 1 compared to Clemson, yet it's Dabo that ends up having the issue. Now, I think Trevor Lawrence potentially is going to be extraordinary. I think he has the potential to be one of the best quarterbacks we've seen in college football in recent history. That's kind of the expectations that he's coming in with in this game starting on Saturday against Syracuse. But it's not uncommon for young quarterbacks or quarterbacks of any age in college football to get knocked out of games. It's typical that you need two. I'm not sure Clemson beats Texas A&M without Kelly Bryant. I'm not sure Clemson's undefeated right now without Kelly Bryant. I think this is a big deal for Clemson's chances to pursue a national championship. I also think this works out pretty well for Dabo because now he can go into every recruit's living room and say, hey, I want to win as bad as the next guy. But if ultimately I decide that you're not the right fit for our program, I'm going to be honest with you. Dabo didn't have to be honest with Kelly Bryant here. He could have waited till the 6th or the 7th or the 8th game to make this switch. And if he had done that, then Kelly Bryant's got to spend the rest of the season on the bench riding it out.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis. Weeknights at 11 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
We are joined now by John Morosi. He is our Major League Baseball insider at JONMOROSI. You can follow him there. He does work for Fox. He's also an NHL expert, by the way. He's a little bit of an expert on everything. John, when we talked to you last week, you said, man, I feel like the Dodgers are in great shape. They were in great shape. They had just swept a series against the Rockies. I believe they were up 2.5 games. It seemed like they were all set to advance in as NL West champs. What's going to happen now?
Well, Clay, good morning. It's a great question because the National League playoff picture now, if you are a team, or if you're a fan, rather, of entropy and disorder and madness and chaos and tiebreaker scenarios, this is your year because we could have one of those Monday-Tuesday combinations of multiple tiebreaker games, which would be a lot of fun to watch, so let's be honest. And the Dodgers now find themselves in a situation where they may be in the middle of that because they have not been able to take care of business this week against a non-competitive or non-playoff-bound Arizona Diamondbacks team. They've lost two out of the last three. That's allowed the Rockies to climb back into first place. And if the playoffs began today, it would be Colorado facing the Braves in the first round, and the Dodgers would be a wild-card team playing Milwaukee in the wild-card game. So, right now, standings-wise, you think about the way things break down, the Dodgers trail the Rockies by a game in the loss column, which makes today's game, the Dodgers are idle today, and the Rockies play the series finale against the Phillies at home. And if the Rockies win that game, then all of a sudden they are a full game up on the Dodgers entering the weekend and with a chance to take care of business for the Rockies at home and win a series against the Nationals and at least guarantee a tie. So they're in a really good spot, Clay. The Rockies are, while the Dodgers seem to have lost their footing, and now they need a big game on Friday for Hyunjin Ryu against Madison Bumgarner, starting against them there for the Giants.
How do you balance out these games down the stretch in terms of the Giants have no chance or they're playing for nothing legitimately? They're playing out the thread. But there's a huge rivalry against the Dodgers. Do you expect them to go balls to the wall trying to beat them? You know, sometimes you get teams who are just like, hey, we're going to put in all our subs. We don't really care what happens down the stretch. How do you break down that series between the Dodgers and the Giants?
You know, it's a great question, Clay, and about this, the mentality and how these games go late in the season. I'm a big believer that sometimes teams that are young and out of it and maybe you're playing a couple younger players, they're dangerous because they've got nothing to lose. Baseball becomes a very hard game when you think a lot and when you consider the circumstances of what you're playing under and when you give in to the pressure. And I know is I covered a couple teams really up close, the Tigers in 06 and 09, and both times they lost the division in the final weekend by playing a team that was out of it and could not find a way to beat them. I saw it and covered one of the more remarkable games in baseball history and nights in baseball history back in 2011 when the Red Sox collapse was complete and that team was done in by the Baltimore Orioles, who I believe were a last place team that year. If you can always see teams that are playing loose and free and with a little bit of something to play for, pride or jobs for next year, any number of factors, and sometimes they're able to relax and just play the game, whereas the baseball will seem very hard to the team that is the front runner or has been the front runner for a while. So I think that the Dodgers may be finding a little bit of that right now, where they lost a series to the Diamondbacks, who've already been eliminated, and now they'll face the Giants and a very proud team. Bumgarner, this could be Madison's final start for the Giants if he's traded this wintertime. Is the Giants that they just fired their GM Bobby Evans, and there's a lot of turmoil there in San Francisco. This may be the last weekend for the band being together, so to speak, with the Giants, and they'll probably want to go out there and do everything they can to change a little baseball history and spoil the postseason hopes of their arch rivals.
All right, let's go into this is an amazing stat that I saw my buddy Cousin Sal, who I do the Lock It In show on FS1, tweet out about how good Jacob deGrom has been. If the Mets had scored four runs in each of his starts, he would be 30-0 this year. If they had scored three, he'd be 25-1. If they had scored two, he'd be 20-6. How unbelievable has that, you know, the record, we always talk about how baseball, sometimes the record doesn't really show us what's actually taking place, right? In other words, the analytics guys have been very successful in baseball. The Bill James era has taken over, where you have to look behind the apparent numbers sometimes to see things. That's a remarkable statistic when you really break it down, isn't it?
That 30-0 is just, I laughed out loud when you read that, Claire. That's just, it's unbelievable. Jacob deGrom, to me, is the Cy Young winner in the National League. I know there's a lot of debate about how much should wins matter. I mean, he's been so historically great this season that I believe it's important for us to recognize that. And wins, you know, traditionally, yes, they've been considered in the Cy Young voting, but I think when a pitcher is this much better than everybody else in this particular season and has put up just historic numbers, he deserves it. And those numbers that you're citing about 30-0 just drives home how remarkably consistent he has been and how we should not, I believe, in this moment, hold against him the fact that he's pitching for the New York Mets. The Mets have had certainly great seasons when he's been there, but this is not one of them. And I believe also Clay is the first pitcher ever in the history of the game with more than 200 innings and an ERA under 2 with fewer than 10 wins. We've just not seen someone be this unfortunate regarding wins and losses who has pitched this well ever. And I think as a result, we've got to recognize that the proper way, which is with the Cy Young.
We're talking to John Morosi. All right, let's go into the American League, where basically the playoff picture is basically set. I mean, as we come down the stretch here, I think we're set. What's going to happen in the AL? How would you break down these matchups as we get ready for postseason play?
Well, Clay, the Red Sox have won 107 games, which is the most in franchise history. They have been an extraordinary team. And yet I think the winner of the Astros-Indians series, so the opposite division series to begin things in the American League, will probably be the favorite in the ALCS, just based on the field, and that's because of their rotation. The Red Sox right now, they're still just bringing Chris Sale back into the fold as a starting pitcher. Sale has had a shoulder issue in the second half, and is not back to his full capability from a standpoint of innings pitched. He's been pitching, I think four and two thirds, I believe, last time out. So the question there is how ready can he be for a game one when you've only thrown 4 2/3 innings your last time out? So I worry about their rotation a little bit in that regard. Meanwhile, the Indians are getting Trevor Bauer back. The Astros, their pitching depth, you know, they may not even have Charlie Morton, but they've got Josh James, the young rookie who's come in and is throwing the ball so well. So the Astros have an embarrassment of riches with their rotation right now, to even to the point that without McCullers and even the question marks around Morton in the rotation. I still think they've got plenty of pitching. So I think the winner of the Astros and Indians, they'll have the edge, I believe, entering the ALCS.
Why is Houston so much better of a team on the road than at home? That's almost unheard of to be as dominant as they are on the road. I think they've got the best record in baseball on the road. Obviously, they're the defending champs. That would bode well, I would think, for the postseason when things get ratcheted up in intensity. You have any idea why that is? I mean, they're 54-23 on the road versus 46-35 at home. Even the Red Sox, who won 107 games, aren't anywhere near as good on the road as the Astros have been.
It's a great question. I would say the baseball side of things, I would always tend toward the pitching side and say that, of course, Houston's a harder place to pitch because of the Crawford boxes and the hitter-friendly dimensions there. So perhaps as a result of that, the Astros just they find it a bit more comfortable pitching away from there. That's the baseball end of things. I think that there's always the human element. I remember back years ago, I spoke to a manager who was concerned that a player had too much going on at home, too many appearances, and not even like social life, just like he was just too busy at home.
Yeah.
And that on the road, away from the distractions and the busyness of home life, he was a better player. So maybe that's part of the psychology too. I can't say that's the case for the Astros, but certainly that's an interesting I guess hypothesis that could be behind why the Astros are playing so much better on the road.
You're a dad, and you're on the road a lot, too. I've traveled a lot over the years. I know when I'm in a hotel, I'm insanely productive, right? I got the gym right there. I've got Wi-Fi. I can wake up and immediately go to work. My kids aren't, you know, showing up and dragging around and asking for things every minute. My wife's not got it. I mean, it's like I always feel like when I finish my work, I'm like, man, I got extra time. Like, that's when I go see movies is when I'm on the road because I'm like, man, I freed up 2 extra hours of my day just because I'm more efficient than I would be when I'm working around the house.
Yeah, that's a great point. I've had that same thought before, Clay. And I always have this rule when traveling for work, never tell your spouse how well you sleep and how nice the hotel is. You always downplay the quality of the hotel and downplay the quality of your sleep. That is never a winning play to talk about those things.
Especially if your spouse is back with young kids the entire time that you're on the road to go see a sporting event. We're talking, by the way, to John Morosi. So if you're the Red Sox, who do you want in this first series? Do you want the Yankees? Do you want the A's? Like, how does that break out in terms of what do you think they're thinking as they look at their potential matchup? And obviously baseball wants the Yankees and the Red Sox to play, right? I mean, that's beyond a shadow of a doubt. That's always the desire. But who do the Red Sox want?
That's a great question. I think this, that they would probably root more for Oakland as an opponent. And I guess it's – so Oakland, they're having to cycle through so much of their pitching, and they've had some pitching injuries there. I think the Yankees, despite their rotation questions, I think there's a little bit more consistency with the New York rotation than the Oakland rotation, at least in how it would profile in a playoff series. If I'm Boston, I'd rather face Oakland. Though the A's have surprised everybody and exceeded expectations, you know, and they're another team that when you think about it, Clay, the psychology that I talked about with those teams with nothing to lose, Oakland's got this amazingly raucous ballpark atmosphere in the playoffs. One of the great underdogs in the game right now. I think that they're a fantastic story, and I think as a result that they could be a dangerous team to face. So I would say baseball strategic sense, I'd rather face Oakland just because I'm a little wary of their rotation depth and even their bullpen pieces, Clay, that they've had to go to them so much during the course of the year that maybe they're showing a little bit of wear and tear towards the end of the season. But certainly that is not an easy environment to play in there in Oakland just because of this the raucous nature and the fans and the excitement that they generate there in the East Bay. I think it'd be a really, really tough series no matter who the Red Sox play in the first round.
All right, final question for you, and we're talking to John Morosi. He joins us every single Thursday in hour two. I know we don't know who's going to win the NL West between the Rockies and the Dodgers, but in the rest of the NL, would you say that, and we don't even know who's going to win the NL Central either between the Cubs and the Brewers, It seems to me that there's a lot more uncertainty in the NL in general. Who do you like as the best team potentially to come out? Now, by next week, we'll know exactly all the matchups and everything else, obviously. But who do you like in the National League as your favorite to advance to the World Series right now?
Well, if they get there, if they get to the wild card round, and we'll see how things play out. But the Brewers have now all of a sudden become a really interesting team. And Clay, one of the reasons, first of all, they've got the MVP, I believe, in Christian Yelich. He's been phenomenal this year, especially in the second half. Best hitter in baseball in the second half. Their bullpen's also really good. And I think that and they're cresting at the right time. They may still surpass the Cubs in the division. We don't know yet. That's a possibility. But I think that, to me, I look at the big picture here and say that the Brewers right now, the way they're playing, they're getting just enough reliable starting pitching. It's sort of a it's not been a superstar caliber rotation, but they've been good enough there. But their bullpen is excellent, and now that their bats are going in a pretty impressive way, and they've got the best hitter, I believe, in the National League right now in Yelich. So I think for all those reasons, it's Milwaukee. But, of course, at the time we're speaking right now, Clay, they're still a second-place team, and they'd have to win the wild card game against right now the Dodgers. So it's fascinating. I mean, the National League, if you're just now tuning in to baseball, it is not too late, because this weekend is going to be extraordinary. Just some great baseball happening. You got Cubs Cardinals on. How about this for a Saturday? Cubs Cardinals at noon Central Time in Wrigley, and then you go down to South Bend to watch the Cardinal and the Fighting Irish there that evening. It's a pretty good sports trip if you don't have plans on Saturday yet.
No, that's phenomenal. By the way, congratulations to your Wolverines. They've stepped it up of late.
They're back in play, Clay, for at least for the Big Ten season. That they're beginning it on good footing, and we'll see. You know, they face Northwestern this weekend, but they still got a brutal schedule: Wisconsin, and Penn State, and they got Michigan State, Ohio State. Still, they could have a really good team and still be only 9-3. I think that's probably still the most likely outcome there for the Maize and Blue.
Yeah, I'm going to this Penn State-Ohio State game in Happy Valley this weekend. So I've never been to Happy Valley before, so I'm pretty excited to check it out and see how that whiteout conditions go for what's obviously a massive Big Ten game. Appreciate the time, my man. Have a good weekend. Enjoy the games.
All right. Enjoy and safe travels, Clay, this weekend. I'll be eager to hear about how you experience it there when we talk next week.
All right. Sounds great. That's John Morosi. Go follow him on Twitter at JonMorosi.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We are going to be joined now by a story that we really have followed over the past couple of years. Doug Adler, you may remember, used to call matches for ESPN, tennis matches. And he lives in L.A. He's up early with us. He was calling a match in the Australian Open featuring Venus Williams. It was a match that was being carried digitally and through ESPN.com, and he decided during that match to describe Venus Williams as charging to the net in the guerrilla effect of tennis. Guerrilla as in guerrilla warfare, G-U-E-R-R-I-L-L-A. Well, this, as often happens in our modern social media era, this clip of him was grabbed from that match. It was shared. He was publicly branded a racist for using the phrase guerrilla effect during a Venus Williams match, and as a result, was fired. We have that audio for you right here. You can hear that if you have never heard it before.
Misses a first serve, and Venus is all over her. And you'll see Venus move in and put the gorilla effect on. Charging.
So, as a result, ESPN threw Doug Adler to the wolves. He ended up losing his job there with ESPN. He was so stricken by the public branding of being a racist that he then had a heart attack, nearly died, spent substantial time in the hospital, has fought back since then, and is scheduled to begin his trial against ESPN in short order in Los Angeles court, and he's going to join us now. Doug, since the last time we talked to you, what has happened? How excited are you to finally have your day in court to hold ESPN responsible for the way that they treated you?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Clay. I'm very excited. It's amazing that it's been nearly 2 years of my life that's been consumed with, I guess you'd have to say, fighting back, right? Fighting back against the behemoth for something that was just incredibly outrageous, ridiculous. And the thing that's so bizarre to me when I hear that playback that you just played for the audience, I was complimenting Venus's style of play. I was actually paying homage to what she does so well. And not only was I complimenting her style of play, but she actually ended up doing exactly what I said. She ripped a couple of balls from the back of the court and then got to the net as a surprise tactic and put the volley away, which we see very few people do these days.
Your life, from the moment that that audio clip went out and then went up on social media, what has happened to you? How much is your life different now than it was the moments before that clip went viral?
My life has been turned upside down. Have worked once in 2 years, and I was only having the opportunity to work because a friend of mine that owned a tennis team in Newport Beach had so much empathy that he wanted to hire me. So he hired me privately for a one-day gig, but I can't get work. ESPN controls at least 90% of the tennis market. You meet people who don't know you, and the first thing that comes to their mind is, oh, there's the racist. So I'm like a leper. My career, my life, my attitude, my confidence in people, my reputation, and I guess more importantly than any of it, my health, you know, both emotionally and physically having the heart attack have just, you know, all been there, have all been something that I've had to fight through and deal with. But look, at no use crying over spilt milk. We are where we're at today, and I'm that much closer to getting my vindication as, you know, we move to the trial October 15th.
ESPN, October 15th, so in a couple of weeks, you will be starting a trial. Before we get to the details on the trial that will be taking place in Los Angeles court there, you're a guy who has spent most of your life in L.A. I think you went to USC. You're a Jewish guy. Had anybody ever called you racist before this clip of 15 seconds went viral on the Internet?
Never. No, not ever. And I think that was... That was part of the shock factor, part of the stress was that, you know, growing up as a Jewish kid, you know, at Griffith Park in Los Angeles and going to school and such, and I was called all kinds of names, names that I don't even want to say. So, you know, I'm quite familiar with horrible usages of racial divisiveness, and no, never, ever had anyone ever considered even thinking of calling me that.
Now, in the aftermath of getting fired and being publicly branded a racist and having your name dragged through the mud and having ESPN not defend you in any way for, as we should mention, using a common word, guerrilla effect, which is a style of warfare, which is a famous tennis commercial between Andre Agassi and Pete Sampras, guerrilla tennis, which Nike made famous when people may remember this old school kind of commercial where they shut down, I think it was like Fifth Avenue, and start playing tennis in the street, Andre Agassi and Pete Sampras. You end up having a heart attack. Like the stress, emotional and physical, from something like this where you're publicly branded, you lose your job, and your doctor says it's stress-related. I mean, ESPN's decision almost killed you.
Absolutely. And you think about it, what could be worse than being called something that you're not? Being called a racist, is there really anything worse? Maybe being a pedophile is worse, but once you're branded a racist, how do you overcome that? And when you're in my business of creative speaking, as you know, and expertise, how do you get your voice back? I mean, if Clay Travis lost his voice, what would his life be like? And the great thing about me having the opportunity to go to trial and fight this betrayal from ESPN is that I get a chance to get my voice back, and I'm fortunate to get that opportunity, Clay. I mean, you know, settlements and such, that wouldn't help me get my voice back. The only way I get my voice back and get a chance to tell the story is to have my day in court. And the terrible thing about all this that led to the heart attack was essentially the betrayal, being promised, if you apologize, you'll save your job. So an apology was demanded. And why would you apologize for something that you didn't do anything wrong with? There's no reason to ever issue an apology if you don't feel you did anything wrong, unless you're told that, well, that's going to save your job. And as, on top of that, we will defend you. We will have our PR team go out there and set the record straight and tell everybody exactly the commonality of the term. ESPN had other writers write about that in 2012, 2013, but no. Instead, they got what they needed from me, threw me under the bus, and you can understand the shock that I went through until people such as yourself tried to help bail me out and help me, you know, try to fight to get my life back.
It's not a surprise to people who regularly listen to this show, but I think oftentimes we have situations where somebody is publicly branded on social media and it's not in any way an accurate reflection of the real world. But your story is particularly unique because ESPN told you, hey, if you apologize, even though you don't believe you did anything wrong, this story will go away. We will defend you. We'll put our PR massive machine behind you. Instead, they got you to apologize, and then they fired you, and they kicked you to the curb and allowed you to be publicly branded a racist.
Yeah, it's you can imagine me even hearing that right now, how angry that makes me. And that's absolute betrayal. It's total betrayal. And, you know, you have something like that happen, and you become suspect of almost everybody and everything in your life. So when you say, well, how's that affected your life? What has your life been like? You can imagine how I feel about trust at this point in my life and don't want to go there, but that's the impact. That's the effect that this whole thing has had on me. And then when I see what ESPN does with other people and how if they care about that individual, like with what happened with Jason Witten the other night when they came out and they issued a statement on his behalf right away, immediately, and cleared up the situation, I say to myself, well, wait a second, that's exactly what they were going to do for me, but they didn't. So they are making decisions arbitrarily based on what they think the value is of the individual that's working for them. That's how
this
I
feel. This decision went all the way up to John Skipper, who at the time was the president of ESPN. He has been since replaced because he says that he had a drug addiction and he was regularly using drugs. Do you think that his drug use may have impacted his decision-making in your case?
How could it not? I mean, if you have someone at the top who has an addiction problem and no one knows about it, and he is running the company and setting the culture for the company, how does it not? Can you imagine someone making a decision with your life and in your role or anyone's life that's fighting substance abuse and saying, well, let's do this or let's not do that, or he applauds the decisions that are being made, and he's not of stable mind or character to do so, and he's playing with my life? I mean, whether he okays it or gives a high five or applauds everyone, this guy is the one who's ultimately, you know, responsible. How can you not think that it is skewing the decision-making process of the underlings?
Your trial starts on October 15th. you have an attorney who is a black guy, I think, and heard your story and was appalled by how ESPN treated you. It will be a jury of your peers in Los Angeles who will be hearing this case and will be able to make a decision about whether ESPN's behavior was appropriate. What do you hope happens at trial? What can you tell people about your attorney? What can you tell people in general about this case as it moves closer and closer to actually going to trial?
With regards to my attorney, I am extremely fortunate to have met an individual who has passion, who has a good sense of what's right, and he's heartfelt. And it just so happens to be that he's with the Cochran firm here in Los Angeles. His name is James Bryant. And it was just fate that I met James and that he was interested in the story, in the case. He and I have become close, and he really relates to what I went through. And the one thing, Clay, that I will share with everyone is when he took the case on, the one thing he said to me was, "This is ridiculous." And that's what you want to hear from someone, regardless of what ethnicity or color or creed or culture. I mean, this is someone who knows the law, who's experienced, who's a good litigator, and he believes in me, and he knows me and my character, and he's fighting the battle along with me, and without him, I wouldn't be having this conversation with you. In terms of going to trial and what I expect, you know, Clay, I want to be made whole. I don't know if that's possible, but I have to give every attempt to try to get my good name back, to tell the story, to let the world hear of the betrayal, of the deception, of the lies. And in doing so, hoping to get my voice back so that everyone becomes educated and aware and thinking, wow, this was bogus. This is not the individual that ESPN portrayed to the world.
The way that ESPN treated you almost got you killed. I mean, you're laying in a hospital room. Your doctor is going to testify that the reason you had the heart attack was in many ways brought on by the stress, physical and mental, of ESPN getting you to apologize and then publicly branding you a racist and firing you. How nervous do you think ESPN, the company, and the executives who are going to have to testify are as your court date moves closer and closer?
That's an interesting question, a hypothetical question. Very difficult for me to answer because I can't figure out really where ESPN has been coming from, because I know that with regards to me personally, they didn't care about me. They just didn't care. So if I said to you they're concerned, they're worried, they don't have any upside, I don't know if that's true or not. They could very easily be going into this with the same attitude of, well, who is this guy? We don't care about this guy. He's nobody. So I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm not going to speculate, but I can tell you that they never thought this case would go to trial. And the fact that it is, I have nothing to lose because I've lost everything. And that should be something that they have to sit with.
What I love about, there are so many things that I love about the judicial system, even though it often is attacked. What I love about it is an individual like you, if you have the law on your side, if you have equity on your side, and if you are tough and you are willing to fight, you can get your opportunity to go toe-to-toe with a cultural leviathan, an 800-pound gorilla, G-O-R-I-L-L-A, the animal, as it were, face-to-face, toe-to-toe, and the people who make a decision are the jurors of the people of Los Angeles right now, many of whom might be listening to us in the city of Los Angeles, and they get to decide, you know what, this guy was not treated fairly, or they can say ESPN treated you fairly and they made the right decision. But you're on an even playing field for the first time in a very long time. Your trial may well last a week. October 15th, it's starting in Los Angeles. When that first moment of that trial begins, what will your emotions be?
I'll feel like I've won. Whether I win or lose, I'll feel like I've won. Because, as you said, in what other country do you get an opportunity to be able to show the injustice and to get the law to state the facts and to get the court of public opinion, which now becomes the jury, to make the decision? That's all one can ask for. I was betrayed. I had a heart attack. I survived. I have a great law firm behind me and great people behind me, lots of support, and I get a chance for my vindication. What else can anyone ask for? And to me, I have to look at that as a win. It's a win because having the opportunity, like David versus Goliath, Doug Adler versus ESPN and Disney, can't get any better than that. And you know what? Whatever happens to me, Clay, I don't ever want this to happen to anyone else. And that in itself would be vindication.
Doug Adler, rooting for you, my man. I can't wait to hear how the trial goes. It begins October 15th in Los Angeles court. I appreciate you getting up early with us out in L.A.
I appreciate your time and everything you've done on my behalf. And again, congratulations with the success of your book.
I appreciate that. Book is going well. But, man, I thanks for Doug Adler. I got to tell you guys, I think this is a big trial. I really do think this is a big trial on October 15th. Because I think companies like Disney and ESPN have gotten used to just throwing people onto the scrap heap of oblivion, even if they haven't done anything wrong, to try to avoid themselves getting tarred and feathered in any kind of negative way. And when you hear a guy use the phrase guerrilla effect, G-U-E-R-R-I-L-L-A, like guerrilla warfare, to describe a tennis match, and then you hear ESPN publicly brand this guy as a racist, force him to apologize, fire him, he has a heart attack, he nearly dies, it's not right. And I think if Doug Adler wins his case and substantially dings ESPN for a massive verdict, then I think a lot of companies will have to go back and recalibrate the way that they make decisions in cases like these. You can't just allow somebody who has done nothing wrong to be wronged like this. You got to defend a guy. You got to stand up and argue for him. I think this is a big case. If I were ESPN, I'd be really nervous. You never have any idea what a jury's going to say. But I think Doug Adler, guy who almost died after being falsely branded a public racist, I think there's a good chance that jury in Los Angeles is going to look at him and say this company did him wrong. And I think ESPN and Disney is going to get walloped here. If I were on ESPN and Disney side right now, I'd be doing everything I could to settle the case. And I know they are. But I think the problem you got with Doug Adler is this is a dude who ain't after money. He's after vindication. He's after letting everybody know that the way he was treated is wrong. You don't ever want to get in a fight with somebody who ain't got nothing to lose. And you certainly don't want to get in a fight in a courtroom with somebody who's fighting for their own good name. Whew! This trial, I wish it was on television. I'd like to watch.